At the age of just 19, Brian formed the Rolling Stones.
I'm milling about with Nick Broomfield, and he is the director of the Stones and Brian Jones. Hi, Nick. Welcome.
Hi. Hi.
So you were 14 years old when you met Brian Jones, and now here you are 60 years later. Amazing.
Yeah, exactly. It is amazing. It's amazing we're all here still. No, it was amazing because as a 14-year-old, the Stones were kind of our heroes, and they broke all the rules and behaved in the way we wanted to behave. And so seeing him on the train was like, wow, it's like meeting one's hero, And then he was so nice and so, kind of kind and well-spoken, and I don't know what I was expecting, but they were sort of famous for doing things like urinating on garage walls and getting fined by magistrates for bad behavior and stuff. And he was just this very well-spoken, middle-class guy, so who was into train spotting too. He, loved trains, and he had a big train set of his own. And I certainly didn't expect any of that. So it was very, left a deep impression on me. And then, of course, he died 7 years later, which was another mystery, because from our point of view, they had everything that we would have loved. We all fantasized about the life they must have. So,
yeah, it's interesting because, a lot of Rolling Stones fans aren't really that familiar with Brian Jones because he led such a short life. It just sort of exploded onto the scene. So what was the impact that you think he left on them now? They've got a new album out.
Great album. Well, I don't know. I guess what he did was he was the founder member, and he sort of, combined Mick and Keith, who I think at that time had their own band, with, Bill and Charlie Watts, and of course himself. And so he put that band together, and I think he, put the adverts out in the newspapers for them. I think Bill Wyman was a electrician or something before he joined the band. So he did that, and also he was the most sort of musically accomplished of the Stones at that time. He had played in another band, and he would spend a lot of time with Alexis Corner, who would bring all the blues artists over from America, and he'd worked out how to play the slide guitar. So he was very instrumental in getting the early Stones together. And I think he would book all the gigs and, all that kind of thing. And I guess was the one who really wanted them to cover a lot of blues artists.
Yeah.
Howling Wolf and Muddy Waters, that kind of thing. But wasn't a songwriter. So his influence kind of finished there, I think.
Yeah. Tell me about reaching out to the Stones. It seems that you've only used audio. Was this because it was during COVID and you couldn't get to them, or what was your access like?
Well, I know Mick and, various other members of the band, but the reason there are very few films on the beginnings of the Stones or on this period is because the Stones are very controlling, and there must be a heap of films that were started and never got finished. And I didn't want to be one of those. I don't think it works well when you have, as one of the producers of the film, the people you're making the film about. I think looking at various films that are playing at the moment on Netflix, where, the participant is also very much involved in the producing of the film, they all fall sadly short. And so, you know, I think to make the film you want to make that you feel is the truthful film, you need to have a little bit of distance from the subject. So I very purposely didn't involve them. And I guess Bill Wyman, who's in the film, was no longer a part of the Stones. So although he was the sort of archivist who collected everything and kept a diary of every single day that he was in the Stones, so that his library, you know, you go into his library, there's this enormous bookshelf full of his diaries of every single day that he was with them. He was obviously an enormous resource. And, you know, I think we just tried to do a very fair portrait of all of them. I don't think any, you know, I think it's just an understanding of that period more than a kind of he did this and he did that kind of film.
Well, you do delve into all the women in his life and his children.
Oh, yeah.
And you got access to his girlfriends, but did you want to reach out to his kids? Was that something to do?
Well, none of his kids knew him. He never had a relationship with his children. So, you know,
that makes
you
sense.
You wouldn't get much insight into Brian from, unfortunately, from talking to them, because, well, also you have to remember he lived to his 27, so he didn't really have a lot of time to have a relationship either. But certainly the women that he was involved with remained very loving towards him.
Most of them.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, most of them, probably. Yeah. Although even Pat, who speaks in that interview, the BBC interview, and clearly is very angry with him, she ran his fan club after that.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah. So, he a very complicated person, Brian Jones. Very, very complicated, very difficult to judge, because he was a person full of contradictions, you know, full of talent, obviously made his girlfriends feel very loved for a certain amount of time and gave them something. And at the same time, you know, I think Bill talks about how cruel and mean he could be at times.
Yeah, they said he was quite the Lothario.
I think so. I thought that was very beautiful, that bit where Dawn's saying, you know, he taught me about my body, and he really knew how to please a woman.
Yes.
And I think she said all that and then was a bit worried about what her husband might think. So, yeah, it was obviously a very, very important part of her life. You know,
obviously,
she loved him very much, yeah.
So what would you say was your best get in terms of who you got to speak with, or the most surprising?
Wow, I don't really know. I think the most, well, it was obviously great to have that interview with Bill. I thought that was kind of rather wonderful, and it wasn't something we were expecting. You know, Bill talks so passionately about the music, their music, and putting together various songs, and how Brian played the Mellotron and played the recorder on, you know, Ruby Tuesday. And he's so animated when he's talking about it. You can really see his love for that music. And I think that was a wonderful, magical thing that happened. So I really enjoyed doing that. But I think over and above that, you just see this very, very complicated, you know, kind of boy man, because he was so young in all of this, kind of struggling to form an identity, struggling to get a clearer sense of himself, and not doing a great job at it. So it's like a jigsaw puzzle of pieces of this, you know, complicated insecure person who was very, very talented and in a way had the world at his feet, but wasn't ultimately strong enough to keep it all together.
Yeah, and I wonder if he was still alive, what the dynamic would have been between him and Mick, because I think when he died, he sort of paved the way for Mick to shine and really become Mick Jagger.
Well, I think Mick was already doing pretty well. I mean, there's only one Mick Jagger, and I think he had already, the footage that's in the film of him at the Albert Hall, you know, with women just, you know, jumping all over him on the stage. I mean, some of that footage of that concert footage of the chaos and riots that they incited with their music has got to be the most amazing, because I guess nobody knew what they were dealing with. So there wasn't really any security there. So the concerts would just, you know, turn into mayhem. And, you know, Mick always sort of had this incredible charisma that was, you know, no one else really had. So I think it was pretty hard to try and even vaguely compete with that.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Brian was very beautiful. And I think at the beginning, he had, you know, more fans than Mick, or more, according to Bill, he got more letters and he had more women. But
well, that was obvious.
But that was for the first year and a half. And then I think, you know, Mick was just so unbelievable that there was no way Brian could compete. And I think his problem was that he, you know, couldn't just make the best of what there was, which was that they were the greatest rock and roll band, and just enjoy the ride.
Yeah.
And I think because his parents were so ambitious for him, it was ridiculously important for him to be seen as being the leader. You know, he couldn't just kind of settle in and get on with it, you know.
I kind of respect that you didn't really touch on his death and you were really concentrating on his life, because his death still remains a mystery and almost like, you know, this weirdness amongst the fans. They still don't really know what happened.
Well, I don't really, I mean, the reason I didn't dwell on it is because I reached out to all those sort of conspiracy theories and read the books and so on. And I think Brian was doing an excellent job in finishing himself off. I don't think he needed someone to come and kill him. I think he was taking so much Mandrax and all the rest of it, and he was out of it half the time. And it was just a matter of when he was going to do something stupid. And, I spoke to Bill Wyman at length, because Bill's girlfriend Ingrid was best friends with Anna Wallen, who was Brian's girlfriend at the time.
Okay.
And Anna Wallen spent the first 4 days after Brian's death with Bill and Ingrid, hiding in the Hilton at Kensington to get away from the press, and just spilt all her, you know, anxiety and sadness. She just went over and over it with Bill and Ingrid, and was quite clear that he had drowned at the bottom of the pool, and she tried to revive him and failed. And then, you know, 10 years later, she writes this book saying that it was murder. And I said to Bill, "How do you explain it?" He said, "Money."
Ugh.
You know,
it's the and worst.
And you know, I just, knowing what I did about him and his mental health and his general ability to look after himself, I found it very hard to subscribe to a conspiracy theory, and I didn't want to open it all up and waste a whole lot of time on the film looking at something that I really didn't think had any validity to it.
Yeah. So what came out of it that would sort of impact audiences today? What do you think they'll learn from it, or what have you learned from it?
Well, I think on one level, it's exactly the same for everybody, whether you're a rock star or not, is that, you kind of have to, outlive, you've got to sort of deal with disapproving parents one way or another. Or, it's about somebody trying to have their life and having a real problem to do so because their family and parents and background disapprove of them. That's it on its most simple level. And then I guess it's also about the intrigues within a band, which is kind of like a family or kind of like a tribe. And what happens to somebody who gets squeezed out? And I think it was very interesting what David Dalton, who was Marianne Faithfull's biographer, said, which is, when you're a member of a band, it's like being in a tribe, a very primitive tribe. And it's like when people in a tribe get forced out and no one wants to talk to them, they go off into the woods and die, because approval from the tribe is the most important thing in their lives. And without it, they can't live. And I think that's kind of what happened to Brian. This was the thing he loved. This was the thing he had created. This was kind of his baby. And he was forced out of it. And he died 3 months later. I think that's the tragedy of it. And also, a kind of very powerful metaphor, I think.
Well, it's a very powerful documentary. And thank you so much for joining me today.
It's been a great pleasure.
Okay. Well, hopefully we'll see you next time.
I hope so.
If you had to do all over again, do you think you'd go the same route again as far as, now that you realize the demands that are put on you as a tremendous success?
I'd do it 100 times over if I could. I love it.
Always news.
Always refreshing.
Always candid.
Always milling about.
Robin Milling delivers what celebrities are saying to you.